I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is September 7th, 2008. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today we return to the website of famed skeptic debunker Winston Wu, where he has a list of 30 arguments against skepticism, and today we're going to investigate argument number 12, in which skeptics supposedly claim skeptics don't have beliefs. They base their views and judgments on the degree of evidence. Winston, before you begin your tirade, I just want to comment on that statement. The second sentence is absolutely correct. We base our judgments on the degree of evidence. As for the first sentence, I think you have tried to create yet another straw man. There are many things that are not known. Skeptics, like anyone else, will hold a certain degree of belief based on whatever evidence is available. Lacking evidence, you can be sure that their belief, if it exists, is very weak, as compared to a much stronger belief in something that is supported by strong evidence. Winston begins, "Not all skeptics claim to be immune to beliefs, but there are some that do. This is plain silly, though, because statements of belief can be found in almost everything someone says. We all do things and say things based on assumptions we have, which are formed, in part, based on beliefs. These assumptions are sometimes in line of beliefs because they are not always based on hard evidence, but are world views, predisposition, and natural tendencies. Beliefs are especially found in the skeptical arguments discussed so far, as most of the skeptical arguments in this article are clear statements of a priori belief. Winston, a priori belief is the hallmark of the irrational mind, not the skeptical thinker. Rationals, that would be me, and irrationals alike, that would be you, Winston, both hold a priori beliefs. Where you separate the men from the boys, I mean the rationals from the irrationals, is how each handles evidence that contradicts their a priori beliefs. The irrationals will only accept evidence that supports what they want to believe. They will dismiss all other evidence. The rational, on the other hand, is the only one of the two that is capable of changing their opinion based on contradictory evidence. That is another way of saying that the skeptical mind is the only one that is open. The irrational mind is the one that is closed. Winston adds, "It is irrational to believe anything that hasn't been proven." Winston, that is pretty much the definition of irrationality. Until you have proof, there is no reason to believe in something. That doesn't mean that you can't think it is possible, but that is not the same thing as believing something to be true. Winston says, "Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence." Actually, Winston doesn't believe that. He is saying that skeptics make that claim. Winston, I already gave you that one a long time ago. Extraordinary claims only require evidence, not extraordinary evidence. Winston goes on, "Further common skeptical beliefs include believers in the paranormal are irrational, psi is improbable, psychics and mediums prey on the gullible, and psi experiments show no better than chance results when proper controls are put into place." Winston, I have to plead guilty to all of the above. Until paranormal activities have been proven, it is irrational to believe they exist. Based on years of unsuccessful attempts to prove the existence of psi, it does appear to be improbable. Psychics and mediums do prey on the gullible and will continue to do so as long as gullible people need to be separated from their excess money. Your last sentence, "psi experiments show no better than chance results when proper controls are put into place," is exactly true as written. Winston continues, those skeptics will claim that their views are based on the evidence that they've examined. They rarely apply their skepticism to their own beliefs, which any true skeptic would do. Winston, then why don't you find these true skeptics? Why do you waste your time on false skeptics? He continues, furthermore, upon close scrutiny, it's obvious that they prefer false explanations to paranormal ones. Winston, what do you think paranormal explanations are? Oh yeah, I forgot. He thinks they're real. He continues, and they resort to character assassinations. Winston, I haven't heard anyone call you the arch-believer. He goes on, and they ignore data that doesn't fit their hypotheses. Winston, they don't ignore data that doesn't fit the hypothesis. They ignore data that doesn't qualify as evidence. Winston says, strange behavior for people who don't have beliefs. Rather, I think that skeptics are using this I don't have beliefs argument to excuse themselves from having to defend their views while shifting the burden to believers and paranormalists. Winston, the burden of proof rests with the claimant. It is true in court. It is true in life. The only one shifting the burden of proof is you, and that is because you cannot prove your beliefs. Continuing with argument number 13 from Winston Wu, where skeptics supposedly make the claim, a common myth is that skepticism is cynicism. It is not. Skepticism is a method of inquiry. To which Winston replies, this statement is usually found in introductions or frequently asked questions sections of skeptical websites and books. Here's an example from the website of the Skeptic Society. He quotes, what does it mean to be a skeptic? Some people believe that skepticism is rejection of new ideas. Or worse, they confuse skeptic with cynic and think that skeptics are a bunch of grumpy curmudgeons unwilling to accept any claim that challenges the status quo. This is wrong. Skepticism is a provisional approach to claims. It is the application of reason to any and all ideas. No sacred cows allowed. In other words, skepticism is a method, not a position. Well, Winston, they pretty much nailed it. Winston says, what these skeptics don't understand is that people in general don't have misconceptions about skepticism as a concept. Winston, you are proof that people do have misconceptions about skepticism. He goes on, the cynicism that people see in so-called skepticism is not due to their misunderstanding of the word itself, but due to the cynical words and actions of the people who call themselves skeptics. Winston, they only seem cynical because nothing in science supports anything that you believe in. He continues, when pseudo-skeptics make cynical statements such as in the arguments presented in this article, they portray to others a cynical, closed method of thinking, dismissing anything that they don't understand or consider possible. Winston, that is a perfect description of how you and other irrationals think. Skeptics are the only ones who are open to evaluating new evidence. Irrationals only accept new evidence that supports their beliefs, and they dismiss any and all evidence that contradicts those beliefs. Winston, the things you accuse skeptics of being guilty of are, in fact, the things that irrationals are guilty of, not skeptics. Winston comments, that's where this impression comes from. No, Winston, that is not where the impression comes from. It comes from the fact that skeptics do not accept unproven claims, which coincidentally happen to include almost all of your beliefs. Winston says, cynics who masquerade behind science and skepticism often reveal their cynicism through their words, thinking methodologies, closed system of beliefs, and dogmatic assertions. Once again, Winston, you have perfectly described the irrational mind. You should look up the word dogmatic and you will discover that it refers to beliefs that are not supported by evidence. Those would be your beliefs, Winston. Winston goes on, The six common flawed tactics described in the introduction of this article are the kind of things that give others the impression of cynicism. This is why even some of the well-known skeptics and leaders of organized skeptic groups are perceived as cynics, including James Randi, the famous magician, author, debunker, and nemesis of Uri Geller, Michael Shermer, editor of Skeptic Magazine, Joe Nickel, one of the leaders of PsyCop, Martin Gardner, psychic debunker, and Susan Blackmore, University of London psychology professor and proponent of the dying brain hypothesis. These people use closed ways of thinking to dismiss data that don't fit into their hypotheses, which is prevalent from statements made in their articles and books. Winston, they dismiss data for which there is no proof. The only people who dismiss data that doesn't fit into a preconceived hypothesis are irrationals. People like you, Winston. Winston says, therefore, these closed-minded skeptics are the ones that have the misconception of mistaking their cynicism with true skepticism. Winston, skeptics are the only people who are not closed-minded. Their conclusions are based only on the preponderance of the evidence. It is irrationals who manipulate the evidence in an attempt to make it fit their conclusions. It is irrationals, people like you, Winston, whose minds are completely closed. And that's enough for Winston Wu for today. Now we'll go to the science segment. Today, interesting meteorological facts. First, the troposphere extends from the surface of the Earth up to an altitude of about 10 miles, which is about 50,000 feet. And it contains all of the Earth's weather. Clouds. Clouds cover approximately two-thirds of the Earth at any given time. They can be as high as 50 miles up. That's 250,000 feet. At night, these clouds, known as noctilucent clouds, can still reflect sunlight due to their altitude. Fog. Fog forms at about 1,200 feet, which is known as the boundary layer, and then it grows down. As cool air rises, it forms fog droplets and grows down. Lightning. It can be dangerous to talk on the phone during a lightning storm. Rain. What makes rain acidic? That would be hydrogen. A rainbow. A rainbow's true shape is a circle, which you could see from a plane. From the ground, you can only see the top half, because light is refracted by the water droplets. The average temperature of the Earth is 72 degrees Fahrenheit. The average rainfall for the Earth is 30 inches per year. And now a bonus fact from the field of oceanography, and that's because there was only one, so I lumped it in with meteorology. There is a 300-foot deep valley in the surface of the Indian Ocean. You thought I was going to say someplace on land. I was shocked by this fact myself. I just assumed, like most other people, that the ocean is at sea level everywhere, but that's not true. And in the Indian Ocean, it actually dips 300 feet, not all at once. It's not a cliff. It's just a deep valley. Now the arena goes abroad. Today we travel to India to stop yoga evangelist Swami Ramdev. Swami Ramdev expects a revenue of $40 million this year, selling India's ancient pre-scientific notion of health care and cure, repackaged as his very special brand. Thanks to his all-out marketing, pranayama, ancient exercise in breath control, and Ayurveda are big hits with the ever-growing, prospering Indian middle class. His daily early morning show has allegedly 20 million viewers. His 500 hospitals in the country are said to register 30,000 patients per day. His new headquarters in the holy city of Haridwar may soon be the world's largest center for yoga and Ayurveda. Swami Ramdev's breathing routine, as such, may be as harmless as useless, but it comes with the stunning claim to cure all kinds of illnesses, including cancer and HIV/AIDS. His brand of yoga, so runs his pseudo-medical argument, increases the CD4 count, the number of cells attacking the HIV virus. Such baseless and irresponsible claims, luring a vast number of patients in need of medical treatment into a false sense of security, turned Swami Ramdev's yoga ministry into a disastrous venture. "Swami Ramdev is a dangerous man," said Sanal Ida Maruku in a press statement. "It is high time that the authorities put a stop to his activities." Claiming such absurdities as against the law, the Magical Remedies Act of 1954 was brought in to stop people such as Baba Ramdev from promoting dangerous ideas about curing cancer and the like. But the political class is running scared of him and of the backlash that his legal prosecution might unleash. Well, that sounds just like here in the United States, doesn't it? And now the article from The Guardian, June 14, 2008. At 5 a.m. beneath the Shivalik Hills in northern India, Swami Ramdev sits cross-legged, swaddled in saffron robes, commanding the rapt attention of 500 devotees of his brand of yoga. The crowd is made up mostly of middle-class Indians, many suffering from chronic conditions for which traditional medicine has little but comfort. Each patient has paid 7,000 to 40,000 rupees, that is $200 to $1,000, to be among the first to spend a week at the Swami's newest venture, a village of 300 bungalows, offering spiritual retreat in the shadow of eucalyptus trees. Swami Ramdev's pitch is that pranayama, the ancient Indian art of breath control, can cure a bewildering array of diseases. Asthma, arthritis, sickle cell anemia, kidney problems, thyroid disease, hepatitis, slipped discs, and it will unblock any fallopian tubes. He tells his audience in the yoga village, who line up to have their blood tested and receive herbal remedies. Although India has a long tradition of mystical gurus, Swami Ramdev represents a new phenomena, the television yoga evangelist. Almost all his congregation have been drawn through his shows on India's Astha channel. Every morning, the Swami appears on television chanting prayers and explaining that ailments, physical and mental, can be treated by what looks like little more than sharp intakes of air and painful-looking body contortions. More than 20 million tune in each day in India alone. The television guru, who is also known as Baba Ramdev, is also available across the world, including Britain. He has just finished teaching on a yoga cruise from India to China, which even after attracting corporate sponsorship, still charged disciples $2,000 a ticket. Last year, he appeared in Westminster to give British politicians a chance to sample his yogic wisdom. Ludi Mantri, a housewife from Mauritius, has paid 40,000 rupees, that's about $1,000, and traveled 4,000 miles to see her Swami in the Haridwar yoga village in the hope he can help her find a cure for diabetes. "I have been on medicines every day for the last 12 years. The chanting of Om has an amazing effect, and the words of Ramdev energize one through the day." Born into a farming family in North India, he retains a common touch, making rustic jokes in chaste Hindi. The guru combines this with a gentle manner and a knack for public relations. The Swami sells himself as a one-person health service. He says he only charges the wealthy and that the poor get his medicines for free. It is no surprise that many sections of the Indian elite, including judges, ministers, and Bollywood stars, that's India's version of Hollywood, have visited his camps. Such is his popularity that the Indian Army incorporated Ramdev's techniques, claiming it made for a deadlier fighting force. Ramdev often speaks less of spiritualism and more of the need to develop his country through yoga, portraying himself as an Indian nationalist. He attacks multinational companies for seeking to drain India of profits. Well, of course he does. He's draining India of profits. He calls Coke and Pepsi good only for toilet cleaning. In a country where renunciation is seen as almost a divine virtue, Ramdev announces that he has long ago given up sex because it is not love. The adoration he inspires was seen in 2006 when Indian communists accused the guru of using human bones and animal parts in Ayurvedic drugs produced by his pharmacy. His followers rioted and attacked the party headquarters. The Communist Party backed down when it saw where public sympathy lay. In an interview with The Guardian, Ramdev said that the problem with communists was that they did not have faith in spirituality and are philosophically against religion. My cures are clean, but the communists have an agenda. I think if you turn that last sentence around, it would probably be true. There is little controversy about his basic assertions. He says that following his yoga teachings for 30 minutes a day, along with a vegetarian diet of raw or lightly boiled food, and no alcohol or tobacco, clears clogged arteries, reduces blood sugar, and lowers blood pressure. But the Swami defended his more extravagant claims that yoga could cure terminal illnesses such as cancer. He also said he had evidence that breathing exercises could help AIDS patients recover by enabling a rise in the number of cells that the HIV virus destroys. Ramdev has an explanation for his success with cancer, that yoga oxygenates the blood which kills the tumor. Yoga is self-healing and self-realization. I have many cases of cancer, which I can provide, where patients have recovered. We have cured blood, throat, ovarian, and uterine cancers with yoga. In the case of HIV, he says, scientists have not understood it properly. He says that through yoga and lifestyle changes, people increase their CD4 count. Those are the cells that HIV virus attacks. The truth, seen for the first time, does not appear like a miracle. Such claims have angered many doctors. Mohammed Abbas, the president of the Indian Medical Association, said that although yoga is a good exercise, it cannot be used to make ridiculous claims about curing HIV or cancer. This is false hope for ill people. The Swami says patients are tested and improvements measured by independent doctors. Asked whether he has run any tests to analyze treatment, he offers a book of testimonies from disciples, convinced they have been cured of cancer, cirrhosis, and kidney failure. Some have called for the Swami to be prosecuted for peddling quackery of the highest order. And now we move to the famous quotes segment of the program. Today, Chet Ramo, born September 17, 1936, in Chattanooga, Tennessee. He will be 72 in just over a week. He is a noted writer, educator, and naturalist. He is Professor Emeritus of Physics at Stonehill College in Easton, Massachusetts. His weekly newspaper column, Science Musings, appeared in the Boston Globe for 20 years. His most famous book was the novel entitled The Dork of Cork and was made into the feature-length film Frankie Starlight. Ramo is also the author of Walking Zero, a scientific and historical account of his wanderings along the Prime Meridian in Great Britain. And now for the quote from Chet Ramo. Coincidence is the science of the true believer.
Are you ready, Bruce? done walking.